This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If a week ago officials hoped for a quick victory in Iraq, there is a different tenor today. This morning, several newspapers cited Pentagon planners speaking in terms of months. At his news conference with Prime Minister Blair today, President Bush said the campaign was proceeding slowly but surely. And in an appearance before the Senate Appropriations Committee earlier today, Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld echoed the caution.
The campaign could well grow more dangerous in the coming days and weeks as the forces close in on Baghdad and begin to have to deal with the Republican Guard forces north of Tikrit, south of Baghdad. But the outcome is assured. The regime of Saddam Hussein will be removed, and the only thing that remains unclear is precisely how long it will take.
Before the war started, there were reports of a basic disagreement between what was described as the professional military, who wanted to send a lot of heavily armored forces to Iraq, and Secretary Rumsfeld, who wanted to focus on high-technology air attacks, special forces operations, and lighter, faster-moving units. That's an oversimplification, and the U.S. and British forces in Iraq today represent a compromise that, publicly at least, both sides say they support. But critics outside the military wonder why there don't seem to be enough troops to protect the long lines of supply or to deal with Iraqi irregulars in cities like Nasiriyah and Basra. They worry that there aren't enough reserves ready to move up if needed, and while they don't doubt the eventual outcome, they ask if it might not have been quicker and less risky with more troops. This hour, we'll talk about how war strategies evolve over the course of a conflict and what the current strategy is. Later on in the hour, we'll also talk with a historian of the Vietnam War about the way politicians use and misuse historical analogies. Join the conversation. What are your questions about what the military strategy is in Iraq? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. We're going to start this hour in northern Iraq, where overnight some 1,000 paratroopers from the Army's 173rd Airborne airdropped into northern Iraq. They're securing an airfield at a place called Harir. This is the largest U.S. deployment in the north thus far. NPR's Ivan Watson was there earlier today, and he joins us now from Sulaymaniyah in Iraqi Kurdistan. Ivan, good to speak with you.
Good afternoon, Neil.
What were those troops doing when you left?
They were establishing some kind of security perimeter around the airstrip. There were men laying in prone position, kind of squinting over the sights of their rifles. Others right beside them digging foxholes right next to their discarded parachutes, actually. So this whole group had kind of fanned out across this area. It was quite dramatic because up until now, the U.S. military presence on the ground here has been very small and deliberately undercover. We've had small special forces teams traveling around in civilian vehicles and pickup trucks and jeeps, and all of a sudden there was this big message, this dramatic show that yes, American troops had landed on the ground, the largest force yet to date.
Well, as you mentioned, small teams of U.S. special forces have been up there working with the Kurds in northern Iraq for some time now. Will the troops that arrived overnight have the same mission, basically, or what is the U.S. Kurdish mission in this area?
It hasn't entirely been clear. We can remember back a month, 2 months ago to when the U.S. was hoping to establish a northern front in this campaign. It was asking for neighboring Turkey, a close U.S. ally, for permission to bring troops in from Turkey, some 60,000 troops. And after months of debate and some disagreements with the U.S., the Turkish parliament rejected that proposal. The U.S. said, we can bring in our troops some other way, but it has waited until now to make a strong statement that it has brought troops in. There have also been disagreements between the Kurds in northern Iraq and the Turks. There was a whole debate about Turkey possibly coming in and the risk of another conflict erupting in the middle of all this. And it appeared that for a while America was not going to send troops in, but focus instead on keeping some kind of stability in northern Iraq to prevent the Kurds from fighting against the Turks if the Turks launched some kind of incursion into the region. And it seemed like there was a holding pattern, and people were giving up on the notion that any northern front would come here. And then this message that came overnight, I spoke with a special forces soldier by the airstrip who said, this is intended, the reason we parachuted in, even though there's a functioning airstrip where transport planes can now land, the reason why we parachuted in part, is to send this dramatic message out to the entire region.
And apparently it was a pretty dramatic scene as the overnight airdrop occurred.
Right. I was not there on the scene. I haven't spoken with anybody who actually saw the parachutes coming down. But the scene on this big flat plane, this rain-soaked plane, was of hundreds, close to 1,000 airborne troops, two helicopters in the open in front of everybody, jeeps that had been, as one soldier described it, heavy-dropped or also parachuted in. And we spoke to Special Forces soldiers who said more is on the way. This is just the beginning.
Now, what is this airfield going to be used for once it is secured? Is it big enough to take C-130s and C-17s?
I'm not an expert, but that's pretty much what some of the soldiers in the area told me, is that it is ready for planes to come in, bringing an awful lot more. They kind of described what's been going on up to date as well in the region. There are hundreds of Special Forces soldiers on the ground that are working discreetly, and they say that they have been crossing this so-called green line, this dividing front line between Baghdad-controlled Iraq and Kurdish Iraq, Kurdish-controlled Iraq, that there have been operations underway so far. And we have to remember there have been airstrikes going on for since the beginning of this war against northern Baghdad-controlled cities of Kirkuk and Mosul and along the front lines. There's been intense bombing of Iraqi army positions along these front lines. So according to some of these soldiers, the northern front has been open. It's just been Just a shadow, in fact, of what's been going on in the south of Iraq with those enormous tank columns.
NPR's Ivan Watson, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ivan Watson was speaking with us by satellite telephone from Sulaymaniyya in northern Iraq. And joining us now from the Pentagon is NPR's Tom Gelton, who's our national security correspondent. And Tom, as we look across at the broader situation in Iraq today, and we're going to be taking your calls, by the way, in a few minutes. So our telephone number again is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And we're discussing military tactics and strategy, and what is the U.S. up to, and is the campaign overly risky? And those are a lot of the questions being raised by critics today. But Tom, begin by telling us how U.S. strategy evolved.
Neil, interesting question. If we go back far enough, there was an extraordinary series of leaks principally to the New York Times and the Washington Post, which are the newspapers of choice for leakers in this town, as you know, whereby we were able to follow here in the public an extraordinary behind-the-scenes debate over how the war plan, the force plan in particular, should be laid out. And just to briefly summarize it, what we saw develop over the months preceding this war was one school of thought, principally associated with the Army, wanting to go in with a big, big force. And this would be sort of the carryover or outgrowth of Colin Powell's doctrine of overwhelming force applied in order to decisively defeat an enemy. And that was reflected in various Army proposals to have, at some point, there was talk of even having almost as big a ground force as was used in 1991. On the other hand, there was sort of the more modern thought that this could be done with as few as, I remember at one point, Neil, 30,000 troops were talked about, 30 to 50,000 troops, along with heavy use of special operations forces and a very heavy reliance on precision air power. So those were sort of the two ends of the continuum of debate. And what happened in the months leading up to this was a kind of a back and forth among the advocates of these schools of thought. We ended up somewhere in the middle, probably a little heavier on the ground force side than some of the air power advocates and transformation advocates were in favor of. Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary, was personally associated with more the sort of lighter, leaner, and more air power school of thought, although he now says that he shouldn't be quoted in that regard. So we ended up with a force of about, we had about 250,000 U.S. ground forces in Kuwait at the start of this campaign. That's fewer than what Army people wanted, but it's more than, we were led to believe, more than what Donald Rumsfeld and some of his like-minded thinkers wanted. Just three divisions. There was, of course, a fourth division that was supposed to be part of this fight, and that's the 4th Infantry Division that was going to come in from the north. I have the feeling that U.S. commanders really assumed that Turkey was going to come through with that, with the approval for that division, and they may have been caught somewhat unprepared for Turkey's reluctance, ultimately refusal to go along with that. So one whole division did not get into this fight, is still not into it on time. So there are just three divisions. But it was a back and forth process between, you know, as I say, different schools of thought that came up with kind of a compromise plan.
Let's go to a caller. Angela joins us on the line from Eugene, Oregon.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got a question. I've been thinking a lot about invasions of Russia and particularly Stalingrad. I was wondering if you think the administration has considered the possibility of just an open slaughter once they reach Baghdad. Do they know how many defenders there are within the city, and are they planning for the possibility of that? And I heard yesterday some critics talking about the presence of journalists perhaps inhibiting our forces too much for, you know, in the use of the necessary force that they need to, I suppose, secure mm-hmm. some of the areas. And how much credence do you put into that? I'll take my comments off here. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Angela. And Tom, interestingly, we just heard a comment from the Iraqi defense minister who said he now expects U.S. Forces to surround Baghdad in the next 5 or 10 days.
Right. Surround Baghdad, he said. He did not say penetrate. And I actually think he's on to something. I think that sounds to me like a pretty reasonable figure. We're not going to hear that from U.S. commanders because, of course, they don't want to give away their operational plan. But I don't see any sign right now, Neil, that U.S. commanders are anxious to rush headlong into Baghdad for the very reason the caller mentions, which is that it's not known how many people in Baghdad will fight, and the last thing in the world U.S. commanders want is to get involved in some kind of street fighting in Baghdad. They would much prefer that the regime teeter a bit more. That the thinking is that if people see the writing on the wall, see that the regime is doomed, see that the end is inevitable, there's going to be far less fighting in the streets. So any way that they can think of to get across that message, I think they're going to pursue that that vigorously, because they really don't want to go into Baghdad and face determined resistance. I mean, in a sense, the journalists in Baghdad are the least of the U.S. military's concerns, because
I think she was talking about the journalists along the routes of supply and whether their presence there might be inhibiting U.S. forces in securing the rear areas.
Well, you know, there aren't that many journalists. They're called unilaterals, the ones that are sort of outside the control of the U.S. military. There aren't that many, but I do know that in this first week, there have been numerous occasions when U.S. military personnel have been diverted from their missions and had to come to the rescue of some journalists who got lost or got into hazardous situations. But I don't think that really amounts to much of a diversion.
We're talking about the evolving military tactics and strategy in the war in Iraq. We have our national security correspondent, Tom Gelton, with us, and we'll take more of your calls when we come back from a break. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN@NPR.org. By the way, to see and hear more war coverage, you can go to NPR.org. You'll find collections of commentaries and essays, extended interviews, reading lists, and other resources. We'll be back shortly. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about how adroit or apt the strategy for war has been since it started last week. NPR's national security correspondent Tom Jelton is with us from the Pentagon. We're taking your calls at 800-989-8255, emails TOTN@NPR.org. But before we continue, let's get this update from NPR's Chris Joyce.
Thanks, Neil. President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair met today at Camp David, Maryland. At a press conference, the president said the war would continue as long as it takes to win. Prime Minister Blair said he will discuss efforts to restart the Iraqi Food for Oil program with UN Secretary Kofi Annan this evening. He also said the UN should be involved in any political reconstruction of Iraq. The Pentagon says U.S. troops are within about 50 miles of Baghdad, supported by a long supply line reaching back to Kuwait. Iraqi soldiers and militia continue sporadic attacks on that supply line. U.S. forces have also engaged in fighting in towns and cities on their way north and report hundreds of Iraqi casualties. In the southern port city of Umm Qasr, coalition forces have been checking shipping channels for mines, a process that has delayed the arrival of humanitarian aid to the area. Reporters in the southern city of Basra say fighting continues there and say Iraqi civilians report a shortage of water. Some aid supplies have been delivered to southern Iraq from Kuwait.
Chris Joyce, thanks very much. And we're continuing our conversation with Tom Jelton. And Tom, I guess we have to frame the tactics and the operations of this campaign with the overall strategy, and I saw a rather succinct description of it in one of the papers this morning, as the idea is to throw out the government rather than to destroy the country.
That's exactly right. The novel aspect of this war, and our military analyst, General Scales, Robert Scales, Major General Robert Scales, has said this on our air a number of times. What's novel about this war is that, unlike any previous war of this size, this war has had a huge psychological component. The idea has been that the United States has not really wanted to fight and destroy the Iraqi military. The United States has wanted this regime to collapse and somehow, we were talking before about the importance of sending messages, somehow get the message to the sort of the pillars of this regime that it is pointless to fight, and also to the base of the regime that they really should separate themselves from the regime and sort of let it fall, to isolate Saddam Hussein and the people around it. And that kind of psychological idea has really framed the military strategy as well. That's why you saw in the beginning this idea that perhaps that end could be achieved through a very high-profile bombing campaign. The term shock and awe entered our vocabulary as a result of that. But it's also been reflected on the ground strategy. Speed and maneuverability have been there's been a premium attached to speed and maneuverability as opposed to securing supply lines, stabilizing the situation in the territory that's been occupied. And this is, I'm no expert on military doctrine, but this seems to be a departure from the way that wars have been fought in the past, where you sort of want to secure your rear, you want to protect your flanks, you want to stabilize the areas that you're going through, and kind of take your time. At least in the initial phase of this war, the idea was to really impress the Iraqi people and the Iraqi military with the speed of this advance and to show people how quickly they could get to the outskirts of Baghdad, thus getting across this idea that this military machine was an unstoppable lethal force, and that perhaps thereby getting people to tip more quickly. So even though it's kind of a psychological strategy, it's had a reflection in the way, in a kind of a tactical way as well.
Let's get to another caller. Robert joins us now on the line from Cincinnati.
Yeah, it seems like it's possible that the military strategy is changing to a war of attrition, and I'm wondering whether it's feasible to just forget about Baghdad for a while. They've sort of secured some of the oil fields. I'm not in support of this war, but the oil fields are valuable, and won't that sort of slowly bring down the economy, or will that lead to a humanitarian crisis in Baghdad? Is it possible to just take parts of the country and sit for a few months?
Tom?
You know that what you were saying before, Neil, is very much true, which is that this, what we've been laying out is what the strategy was at the beginning of this campaign. We have seen it being adapted on the fly. And I think it's entirely possible that now that there is some reconsideration taking place, The securing of the oil fields is a very high priority. It's always, already has happened in the south. They're moving very slowly to do it in the north. So, you know, the fact that this regime has not tipped as quickly as many in the administration hoped it would, the fact that the shock and awe campaign did not, it seems, shock and awe the Iraqi leadership, may now be prompting some reconsideration of whether it makes sense to continue with this very high-velocity move. Maybe now it does make sense to spend a little bit more time securing the territory and, in particular, the oil fields. So I think at this point all options are open. I think there's some fairly major reconsideration of the war plan taking place right now.
Can you man the oil fields and make them productive? Is that feasible? Is that logistically possible? And if so, if the would then Baghdad, would there be a humanitarian crisis in Baghdad ultimately, in which case there'd have to be some intervention, or can you sort of isolate Baghdad humanely?
I think that the immediate priority is simply to secure the oil fields. I doubt very much they'll be bringing in, I mean, the U.S. military can itself operate oil wells, obviously. That would require really outside private industrial people coming in on the one side, or else the Iraqis who have been running those oil wells for a long time. But in order for either one of those two things to happen, there's going to have to be far, far greater security than there is right now. So I would say that the humanitarian situation, getting in supplies, getting in food, and getting in water, is really on a whole separate track from the oil field issue.
Robert, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Joining us now from his home in Warrenton, Virginia, is retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters, who served in the United States Army and has written several books on military tactics and strategy. Colonel Peters, welcome.
Welcome, and now you've told the Iraqis where I live.
Well, let me tell them where you've written recently. You said in this week's Washington Post that the United States would win the war despite what you described as serious strategic miscalculations by the Office of the Secretary of Defense. Strategically, what do you think those miscalculations were?
Well, I think there's no question that right now the men and women in uniform, in our country's uniform, and the Brits are pulling Donald Rumsfeld's iron out of the fire. Rumsfeld made two miscalculations, and he was a decision maker. He's very much a centralizer. The first was shock and awe. That was still a worthwhile effort. It was an attempt to make warfare more humanely, to reach across the intervening troops, reach past the civilians, and go after the truly guilty, to cut off the head of the snake, to convince the key leaders in the country and the key subordinates to surrender. Well, the technology and intelligence still wasn't quite there, might be in a future war. We made the mistake of not really doing shock and awe. The punches just weren't thrown hard enough. In order to really shock and awe anybody in this regime, you would have had to stage much more intense and, frankly, crueler strikes. And the third thing is shock and awe, while I think it might have worked very well against Belgium, they forgot to take into account the enemy, which is something no military plan should do. Saddam Hussein, his sons, and their key paladins, the people who make that regime run, are never going to surrender. I mean, the core, hardcore people, because they know if they surrender, they're not going to exile in the south of France. When, as much as we know about their crimes to date, they know that even more will emerge. So shock and awe, a worthy attempt to make more warfare more humane. I support the effort, even though the execution was botched. Now, the bigger and much more dangerous error was Secretary Rumsfeld's insistence on a troop cap, on limiting the number of ground forces that participated in the war. And Secretary Rumsfeld, an admirable man in many ways and a strong, decisive leader, nonetheless is an arrogant man. And I know Tom probably can't talk about it in the air, but I know he sees this in the Pentagon all the time. No secretary, at least a Secretary of Defense, at least since Robert McNamara, has made himself so hated by the people in uniform because he treats them absolutely arrogantly. And Tommy, General Franks, begged for more troops. And the only reason we have as many troops as we do in the theater right now, spread very thin and fighting very hard, is because General Franks fought for months to get them. At one point, Secretary Rumsfeld's civilian advisors believed, men with no military experience, believed that this war could be basically won with air power and two army brigades, about 7,000 or 8,000 combat troops. Well, you know, the myth of air power winning wars has been around since the 1920s. America's military works best synergistically. All the services exist for a reason. And what we saw, I mean, thank God for Tommy Franks, General Franks, arguing for those other troops, because now we at least had enough troops to make a tremendously successful advance on Baghdad. And this war, despite the criticisms I'm making, has been tremendously impressive and successful to date. And, you know, the last thing I'll say about that is we've had a tremendous stroke of luck that no one has yet recognized. You know, our troops are spread very thin on the ground. We need more troops. Should have had them there at the beginning. Thank God the Turkish parliament, without intending to do us any favors, told us we could not send the 4th Infantry Division through Turkey. Now, they would have been helpful in the north, but they're not needed there. They're badly needed in southern Iraq, and because the Turks would not let us send the 4th ID through Turkey, they were able to steam through the Red Sea in the Gulf now, and they'll be in the battle in a week or 8 or 9 days. And so our troops are going to be fighting hard for a week. The numbers just aren't as many as we wish on the ground, but even those nuisance attacks in the rear, the attacks by the Fidayeen or terrorists or whatever you wish to call them, they're mosquito bites. They're painful mosquito bites, but they're mosquito bites. And so I want to be very clear that although I'm criticizing what I regard as a failed strategy, this war is going astonishingly well. We have taken fewer casualties so far, fewer casualties than were killed on America's roads last week.
Let's get a caller involved. Andy joins us now. Andy's with us from Williamsburg, Virginia.
Hi. I think that if our troops are spread thin enough that they draw out Fayyum Saddam to attack us, where they die by the hundreds and none of our people die, and that seems like a brilliant strategy and not some strategic failure.
It's not a strategic failure. Never said that. It's a strategic error, because while our troops are performing, it's easy for us to talk about this here in the comfort of America and the safety. The 3rd of the 7th Cavalry fought for 72 hours straight. No time to sleep, eat, or do any other, you know, no hygiene functions, just straight fighting on the march. Now, our doctrine says that at a certain point, troops need rest. You relieve them. We should ideally have had a reserve. We have no heavy reserve in the theater. So while the troops are pulling this one out by sheer guts and skill and training, those are very tired soldiers. Saddam is desperate. He is throwing wave attacks at us. And by the way, we're killing some of the people that the future of Iraq doesn't need. It's actually a blessing in disguise. But don't forget about how tough it is for those soldiers out there. Everybody needs sleep. If you're being shot at around the clock, firing back, even if you're winning big time, at some point people fall asleep over their guns. We do not have enough soldiers in there to do it with a comfortable margin, to take care of the troops. And there's a rule in military affairs, and that's you always give the commander, the combat commander, what he asks for. Les Aspin didn't do it in Somalia. Donald Rumsfeld did not do it in this war. Fortunately, we're going to pull this one out, and big time.
Andy, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Ralph Peters, thanks to you as well.
Hey, my pleasure.
Former retired Lieutenant Colonel Ralph Peters' most recent book is Beyond Terror, Strategy in a Changing World. We're talking with NPR's national security correspondent Tom Gelton about tactics in the war against Iraq, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Tom, an email question from Paul Bogdanich in Portland, Oregon. As a former Marine, he writes, I have a question. Your whole discussion is couched in the logic that people give up in the face of hopelessness. Since when? People often fight to the death. What about that reality and the conclusion that this whole war and the strategy behind it are a colossal mistake?
Well, I'm not saying this is my point of view, Neil. I'm saying this is the point of view of those who designed this strategy. I think that Colonel Peters actually made a very important point, which is that the idea was never that there is a group of people that Donald Rumsfeld calls the dead enders, or the bitter enders, those who, like this retired Marine says, who are willing, for reasons of loyalty, fanaticism, ideology, whatever, who are willing to fight to the very end. But there is a much larger group of people who may, for the time being, be allied with the regime, but who are not willing to fight and die to the very end, who sort of are aware of which way the wind is blowing, as it were, and when they do see that the regime is doomed, would in fact switch. So it's not that Saddam Hussein and his sons and those close to him and the thousands, perhaps, of diehard loyalists, it's not that they would surrender. It's not that they would give in. It's that the sort of the silent majority of the regime supporters would switch sides, and that would be the decisive switch.
Let's go now to Tom, who's with us in San Antonio, Texas.
Hi. I want to ask a question about the force strength of our military. Currently, many of these people have had their tours extended to keep men for the war. How long can they extend those tours, and are people joining up to replace them?
You know, I think that is such an important issue. I am very anxious to look at recruitment and retention rates in the aftermath of this, particularly, for example, in the Navy. The Navy deployments have been, for those sailors who are in this current war, I think there are now five carrier battle groups, U.S. carrier battle groups deployed, and some of them are on extended deployments. Those deployments, when we've had downsizing in the past few years, those deployments had already been extended from what they were a few years ago. In some cases now, you're seeing deployments up to 9 months. What kind of family can withstand that kind of stress? What kind of marriages can go through that kind of stress? And I think that, you know, this is going to be an issue. You'll first perhaps see it in terms of retention and how many people re-up. Recruitment is a little different because you often have young people, single people who are looking for adventure, who don't have family ties. You may not see it so much in recruitment, but in retention, which is something very serious, something the military is concerned about a lot, because that's the officer corps that they're worried about, and the experienced NCO and enlisted corps that they're worried about. That could be a real issue here in the coming years.
How long can we keep these people in now? Can we force them to stay in?
Well, there is a stop-loss regulation or law in place now in, I think, all the services that basically says that even if you're due to leave, you can't leave. I mean, that's something that the U.S. military is permitted to do in times of national emergency, when there's a national security threat and so forth, to impose these stop-loss regulations, and those are in effect. I know their effect in the Marines and in the Air Force, and I'm pretty sure in the Navy and Army as well.
How long will they keep them going?
That's up to the Commander-in-Chief.
Tom, thanks for the question.
Thank you.
And Tom Gelton, thank you very much for joining this hour to talk about the military tactics and strategies as they've been applied so far in the war in Iraq. We appreciate it.
Anytime, Neil.
When we come back, we'll get an update on the situation as it's been developing throughout the day today. And we'll also talk with a writer and historian of the war in Vietnam about the use of historical analogies to justify armed intervention from Munich to Kosovo. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.